कुन्द्रेक्षु चाबक्सुमेषु श्रुणीना
Translation of the Tamil song is, O Mother of Love, Queen of the Universe, O Divine Mother, Joy of the Gods, Giver of Bliss, First Cause, Supreme Power, the Undivided Guardian of Righteousness, Cause of the Word, I take refuge at your feet.
Yeah.
I hope the music attunes us to the divine mystery which we're going to reflect on. And I'd like to suggest that there are three stages, at least, in the evolution of human consciousness. And the first stage, which may have gone for hundreds of thousands of years, was when humanity was one with nature and with God. Human consciousness had not yet evolved. Consciousness begins to divide, to separate, but before consciousness develops, there is unified awareness, and all is blended together in one. And we all experience this. We were all once in the womb. And in the womb of our mother, we were in that state. They call it deep sleep, sushupti. And we were totally one with nature, one with the mother, one with God. So there was no divisions at all. And we all emerged from that state in the womb. And every night, if we go into deep sleep, we go back to that womb, to that source, to that primeval state. And it's behind our lives all the time, you see. We never lose touch with it, really. We're always in touch with this primordial sleep, we call it, but as a waking sleep, really, you see. There was an awareness, it was human, God was present, but there were no distinctions, no differences, no division had yet occurred. You can call it paradise, if you like. And then, the next stage is when consciousness begins to emerge, and we grow into the dream state. And that is also the state of magic. The early stages, the hunting peoples, for maybe 100,000 of years, they were roaming over the earth hunting animals, and they lived in that dream state where everything flows into everything else. There are no clear-cut divisions. We've got our conscious mind, we cut, divide, analyze, separate everything, but they were still living in the dream state where everything flows into everything else. And particularly with men and animals. You see, hunting was the great work, and there was a very deep sense that you were in communion with the animals. And there were magic practices you would make in the caves, you know, they found in the south of France. You would have a bison or some animal, and you stick an arrow into it. And the belief is that if you image that bison and stick your arrow into it, it'll affect the animal. So everything is affecting everything else. It's a magical world. And that went on probably for hundreds of thousands of years. People were living in that dream state. So we begin with the deep sleep, where we're not conscious scarcely at all. And then we emerge into the dream state, the state of magic. And then the third stage is when distinctions begin to be made, consciousness begin to grow, and this is fairly recent, say from 10,000 BC, and really developing from about 5,000 BC with the great agricultural civilizations. See, in the early ages, men were hunting, they had no settled abode, very like the Australian Aborigines now, you know, always going from place to place, hunting the animals, living from day to day, with no sense of time at all. It was a sort of magical state. And then when agriculture began, you had to plan ahead. You sowed your grain, and you had to expect a harvest in 9 months or whatever. And so you began to have a sense of time, and the calendar came into being, and all civilized life really began with these agricultural civilizations of Egypt and Babylonia, also the Indus Valley, the Yellow River in China, all these big rivers produce this agriculture. And that is when, as I say, time really begins, and space, you space out your dwelling place, you have a fixed dwelling place now. And so things began to be settled. And now we get this emergence of the worship of the Earth Mother. And that was one great stage, a matriarchal stage. You see, we come out of the womb ourselves, each one, and we know ourselves in relation to the mother. That's the first experience of every human child. And then we begin to realize how we totally depend on the earth. Our food comes from the earth. And the mother was the one who prepared the food. And in these agricultural economy, the women were the people who did the work, mainly in the fields and planting the vegetables and so on, and harvesting and cooking and preparing the meals. So the mother was everything at that stage. And we get the worship of Mother Earth, Mother Nature, the Mother Goddess. And in all the great civilizations, you get this figure of the Mother Goddess, Demeter and Cybele and Isis and Ishtar, so many of these great figures of the Mother Goddess. And they dominated the horizon of humanity for 2,000 years at least. So that's our next stage, where the Mother Goddess is everything. And as I mentioned, it's rather important where we are in Tamil Nadu. You see, India belonged to this primordial civilization, and many people today, the Vedas may date back right back to 5000 BC or so, and it was this very early culture where the mother was still very strong, but the father god came in with the Aryans. They invaded India in the second millennium. They invaded Greece and Italy and Europe and Persia and so on. And they brought the father god with them, the sky god. And this is a universal phenomenon. The father in the sky. There's an ancient Indian god, it's not known today, called Dios Pita. And Dios, D is the word for the sky, Pita is father, sky father. And in Greece that became Zeus Pater, the same thing, and in Latin Jupiter. So all over that Aryan world you had the sky father. And it's very interesting, when Jesus taught his disciples to pray, he could think of no other word except our father in the sky. O Pater Hebraeus Oronois. And Oronois is heaven, if you like, but it's, and perhaps that we should qualify that. You see, when we say sky, we think of some material vault or some substance, some dome of some sort outside us. But in the ancient world, you never separate the physical from the spiritual, so that the sky was the presence of the divine. The divine was in the sky. So our Father in heaven is a perfectly good translation, but remembering that heaven always implied the sky, the great dome of the sky, and God is dwelling up in the heaven above. So we emerge into this worship of the sky father and the patriarchal culture. And that only emerged, you see, in about the second millennium. From the fifth millennium to the second, we had mainly this mother goddess, the mother earth, mother nature. And then this rather warlike Aryan people, they conquered these more settled places, destroyed them very often. In India we had Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, two very ancient settlements from the second or third millennium. And the Aryans came and simply wiped them out and settled themselves in all what North India. And probability is that the Dravidian people, who were more the ancient people, were driven south. And where we live in Tamil Nadu is a Dravidian. They're quite different racial character and features and so on. And it's so interesting, as I was saying, we have many temples around us, and many come from the gods of North India, but all the local Tamil temples are to the Mother Goddess. Mariamma is her name very often, and Amma means mother, of course. And so there's tremendous devotion to the Mother. And interesting, in the Catholic Church in Tamil Nadu, and they said in India, the Virgin Mary is the Mother. And if you ask for a Catholic church in a Tamil town, you ask for the Mother Kovil, the Mother Church. It's the Church of Mary. Interesting. Mary is the figure of the Mother, you see, and that's taken the place of the Mother Goddess for many people. So, we move out of this mother worship, Mother Nature, into this worship of the Sky Father who's above in heaven and who has thunder and lightning and rain for you, but also punishments and thunderbolts and so on. And so you get a God who is to be feared. And we have to remind ourselves, you see, that we've emerged from this patriarchal culture. It came out with the Hebrews, one of these Semitic people who invaded Palestine in the second millennium and brought this cult of the God with them. And all through the Old Testament, we have, now this is very important, we have this, the Father God suppressing the Mother Goddess. And it's a main theme of the Old Testament. Everything connected with the feminine was put down. It was a necessary stage. You see, the danger of the feminine, I hope you want my saying so, is that the mother can devour. She's very loving and cherishing and does all that, but she's also devouring, and she's possessive, and she wants to possess the child. And so the child, there's many legends of the mother devouring her children, you see. So Mother Nature is very beautiful and wonderful, very cruel and brutal she can be. So you have to escape from the mother sometime. And then you have to reconcile, of course, again, but you must escape. And the Hebrew revelation is the moment when humanity was escaping from the devouring mother and opening itself to the Father above, the transcendent God, who is above nature, above creation, above humanity, and who commands you and you have to obey, and who punishes if you don't. So that's what we inherit. And we must remember that they were in contact with the Canaanite religion in Palestine, as well as the Egyptian and Babylonian, and there were many fertility rites. There was a big problem, you see, with the mother, fertility is a great need, and the fertility of the family and the people, and the fertility of the crops. And some of the main rituals were to assure the fertility of the crops. And there was a great deal of sexual freedom in this aim of bringing fertility to the crops. See, sex was seen as the vital energy, the divine energy really, which had to be released in order to bring forth abundant harvests and so on. And so there was a great deal of immorality, as we would understand it, in these cults, these fertility cults, and also a great deal of cruelty. There was offering up, sacrificing children to the goddess. Another strange thing, you would hardly believe it, you know, but in India today there is still that belief. If you want to construct a bridge or something to be firm, you should bury a child in the foundations. And it's quite alive today. We had a bridge at Kulitadai, about 2 miles from us, and I was told many of the mothers were terrified that their children wouldn't be kidnapped and buried. And one Franciscan father told me that they had some workmen to dig a well for them, and they insisted on throwing a baby down into the bottom of the well. That was this century, years ago. So these superstitions, if you like, they go on, you see, from age to age. And the Hebrew prophets were faced with this fertility cult, this slaughter of children, sacrificing children, and rites of that kind, and these orgies which took place at the time. So there was a tremendous reaction against the mother, against the feminine. And you can't understand the Hebrew prophets unless you see it in that context. They're very violent, you know. There's always tremendous denunciation of people. You're wicked and God is going to punish you. And a terrible cruelty. Probably some texts, but I didn't bring them with me. But if you like to look them up, you know, when the Israelites invaded Palestine, and the Arabs can't forget that today, They were told to massacre men, women and children. You must have nothing to do with them. They're these worshippers of the evil spirits, you see. They must be eliminated from the land. And so they would massacre people. They would take a city and everybody in it had to be massacred, men, women and children, and then cleaned up. And then the holy God could come in and take over. So all through the Old Testament, there's this tremendous violence. And God is a God of justice, true, and he has mercy for those who respect him, but he's no mercy for people who don't accept him or don't believe in him, and he punishes and judges and condemns. So we go through that tremendous stage of judgment and of condemnation, and of which emerges eventually the figure of Satan and hell. It took a long time, but that is the history of Israel, you see. Gradually, this God of Israel, who has, you see, we have to face the fact that the divine and the demonic are extremely close to each other. When the divine is open to the transcendent and is free, then it is a power of creation, a fullness of life. But when the divine separates itself and becomes centered on its own ends, it becomes demonic. The same force which is divine can come demonic. And so you get a demonic element in the Old Testament. You get it very strongly in India. See, Shiva is a great example of a god who, on the one hand, is the creator. He creates everything, the whole universe, and he's at the heart of the universe, dancing at the heart. But he's also the destroyer. He keeps destroying everything at the same time. So creation and destruction go on side by side. And so also in the Old Testament, Yahweh is the God, the creator, but he's also the God who judges and condemns and destroys. And he leads his armies of Israel to fight against his enemies and so on. So we must face the fact that we come out of this patriarchal culture with all its violence, and we're still suffering from it, you see. It's got into our lifeblood, really. I'm particularly concerned with the Psalms, you know. I don't know whether you've started reading them seriously, but I've been reading them for 50 years, you know, and I've never worried about them. We did them in Latin, and it seemed to go nice smoothly. And even now in English, it didn't seem so bad. But when you begin to look at the literal sense of the Psalms, it's terrible again, you see. The hatred and the violence and the anger and the revenge, calling on God to destroy these people, and I will have my vengeance upon them, I will repay, says the Lord, and so on. So all that, you see, is part of this patriarchy, and it was a necessary stage. You had to break with nature. Nature is, as I said, she's beautiful and seductive, but she's also terribly corrupting, and she devours you, as I say. She drags you into herself and devours you. And they had to separate. And so there is a stage when we are one with nature and at peace, and then we begin to discover a negative side, and we have to break with the mother, we have to separate, and we get the transcendent God. And eventually, the figure of Satan is very interesting, you know. He appears in the book of Job, probably written about 400 BC or something, fairly late. And he's one of the sons of God, then. He goes up and down, looking in the world and so on, and seeing what's happening. And then, by the end of the second century or so, he becomes the Satan we know, the enemy of God, the lie, the deceiver, the evil power, you see. So a total dualism, the good, righteous, holy God, and the wicked, self-violent, hateful cheat and the liar, the devil, you see. And that again, we've inherited this dualism, you see, of the Old Testament. And it was a stage which is necessary. If you don't go through that stage, you go on tolerating evil endlessly. And there's a real problem in India with that, you know, that they tolerate almost any evil, really. It's rather typical, you see, in Calcutta. You get all these people dying in the streets, you see, and nobody really worried about it until Mother Teresa came along. And this hospital said, we can't take in all these dying people, we've got too many already, you see, to deal with. So they wouldn't take them in, so they leave them on the streets to die. And Mother Teresa comes along, and she takes them into her, she got a Kali Ghat, you know, a temple of Kali by the river there, that was allowed to use it, and she collected all these dying people there. And there are wonderful stories, you know. I remember one that they picked up an old man, he'd been lying in the streets for days and weeks probably, and he was eaten up with maggots with worms and so on. And they cleaned him up and took out all the worms and so on and made him comfortable and quiet. And he died after an hour or two. And the last thing he said, I'm going to God. You see, that little sense that he was cared for, that there was some meaning in his life, had changed his whole life, really. I'm going to God, he said now. Because he knew there was something more than all that misery in the streets. There was some love, some concern. And that's what people are looking for. So, that's the other side of it. You see, you have to learn not to tolerate all this evil. You have to face it and to overcome it. So we have to go through the Old Testament and the law. St. Paul was very good on this, you see. He saw the law is necessary. You know, St. Paul has three stages. Man under nature, which I've described, when you're one with nature and you don't feel the conflict at all and you just live as part of nature. Then comes the law, your consciousness begins to develop, you begin to realize the things you've been doing are not right at all, and you're tolerating things that are quite wrong. And so the law comes in to teach you to take these discernment and to judge and resist the evil. And then, as St. Paul saw, the law won't save you. It's no good just condemning and judging evil and trying to separate yourself. You have to go beyond the law. And his whole gospel was there is something beyond the law, beyond the rational, legal justice system, you see, which is grace, which is love, which is transcendent. And that was his answer to the problem. So we have to go through the stage of the Old Testament, the patriarchal stage of the judgment, and heaven and hell, you see, all this dualism belongs to this world of Israel. You see, it's all dualistic. God is separate from the world, and human beings are separate from God and from the world, and human beings are separate from one another. As consciousness grows, you have to divide and separate, whereas I'm not you and you're not me, and all these divisions occur, and it's a necessary stage. But the next stage, you've got to realize that in spite of all the divisions and between people and between us and God and creation, there is an underlying unity. And we lose sight of the unity. We get caught up in this endless division. And what David Bohm, one of the great scientists today, calls a fragmented universe. Everything and everybody is divided into fragments. We're all separated, and everything in nature is separate. And we're all dividing and separating all the time. Our whole science is an analytical science, dividing and separating. So we land ourselves in this world of fragmented universe. And now we're reaching that point when we realize we have to go beyond the divisions, you see, and the fragmentation, and rediscover the unity. We began from the unity, as I said, in the womb, in the original. We were all one. And then, as consciousness developed, we discern these differences. Then we begin to come into conflict. Then we begin to separate. And then we get this dualism all through all our lives. Everything is divided. And then, the next stage, we have to go beyond dualism. And that is the challenge today for the church and the world, to go beyond this terrible dualism. And you see, unfortunately, well, I don't know if it's unfortunate, we just have to accept it, Christianity came out of Judaism, and Jesus himself, as a Jew, inherited this dualistic tradition of Israel, and he speaks the language of Israel, of the Old Testament and of the prophets. But he was taking people out of that dualism, and the New Testament, the New Covenant, the New Age, is precisely the moment when Israel is emerging out of this dualism and has been taken into the non-dual mystery beyond. And it's very interesting that all through the Old Testament there is a faith that something new will come. You see, you had the Old Covenant, God with Abraham and with Moses, and there was God up there and Abraham, Moses, and being told what to do and so on. It was dualistic. And then the idea grew there would be a new covenant, and that covenant would be one where all humanity would know God. There wouldn't be just one or two chosen people and so on. All would know the Lord. That was the new covenant. And then you had the old law, Moses on Mount Sinai, and don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't steal. All the law was enforced on people, and violently enforced. Moses came down and slaughtered the people because they were worshipping a golden calf and so on. So you had the old law, but the belief was a new law would come, which would be written in the heart. No longer a law imposed from without, telling you must do that, mustn't do that. A law written in the heart, which responds to your own deepest instincts, you see. And that is the new law. And then, very wonderfully, in Isaiah, you have the idea of a new creation. This whole creation is a fallen world, you know. You see, it's fallen from God, fallen from the whole. The whole embraces everything in one, but we've fallen out of the unity into these fragments, this division. And so this world is fallen from the unity, and this creation will pass away. Everything divided and so on, as we see, will pass away. As the Buddha says so clearly, everything is passing. Everything is unsubstantial. It's all passing away. But the belief was a new creation would emerge out of the old. It comes in Isaiah, I hold a new heaven and a new earth. And Paul talks of a new creation. And the book of Revelation, the last chapter, is very interesting. Whereas Genesis said, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, the book of Revelation said, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. So the hope is that this world will pass away, all the conflict and the division and the divisions and the dualism will pass, and the new creation, the new world, new life will come into being. So that, as I see it, is the drama of human history. You see, emerging out of the unity, coming into consciousness, and mind you, some people suggest that consciousness itself is the cause of the trouble. Some of you may know Ken Wilber's book, Up from Eden. It's a fascinating book, and it covers the whole of human history, but he sees consciousness had to grow, consciousness inevitably caused these divisions, and it was a process of growth, we're up from Eden. But I think there's another possible interpretation, and that is this. As your consciousness develops, you have to divide, to discriminate, to discern, separate yourself from your mother and father and brothers and sisters and so on, then from the world around you and so on. You have to make this differentiation. But then you have to reunite. You divide in order to unite. You must never lose sight of the unity behind the division. And that's what we do. We fall into this dualistic mind where everything separates and is divided, and we forget the unity which is holding it all together. And if we held to that unity, then there would be no fall. We wouldn't fall into this duality, you see. We would observe, know the differences and realize them consciously, but we would remain in the unity. So I think that was really the call of humanity. And of course, it falls into this division, and we've probably reached today the limit of division in humanity, you know. It's never been so divided, probably. Every human being is separate now, You see, the kind of individualism we have in America is something quite modern. And even today in India, and still more I believe in Africa, people feel much more members of a whole, of a family, of a community. As an individual, you count very little very often. You're part of that whole. So we've grown out of that, and we've acquired individuality, each separate, and now we have to recover the unity, you see. We had to find the difference, but now we have to recover the unity. And that, to me, is the final state of humanity to which we're all moving. We start from the unity, we gradually come out into the divisions and into the dualities, and now we're moving. And I think the New Covenant, the New Testament, is the beginning of this return to unity. Christ comes to reconcile all these opposites, to restore the unity which has been lost. And we're still emerging into that unity, you see, and we're still a long way to go. But that is really the challenge, and that is what is happening in science today. I don't know whether you're familiar with Christoph Capra's book, The Tao of Physics, and also his other book,
The Turning Point,
where he applies it to economics and society and the whole human world. And what he brings out, and David Bohm, who has the same view, is that science today is teaching us that behind all the divisions which we recognize, galaxies and stars and planets on Earth, and then the atoms and molecules and all these divisions, they've discovered, you see, that behind all those divisions is this underlying unity. And they describe the universe now as a field of energy. There are no particles anymore. But you know, certain experiments, a particle appear, another it'll disappear, and they realize ultimately they're waves of energy. So we're rediscovering the unity today. Behind all the differences, which are real and we have to recognize them, is this sea of energy, this ocean of energy in which we're all immersed, you see, and are all sharing with one another. And so science today is teaching us that there is this unity behind the whole physical universe, and now we have also to discover it behind the psychological universe. Because again, you see, we've got this individual psychology. We think of ourselves as quite separate with our body, our soul, our faculties, our distinctive character, and all the rest of it. And we stop there at the separated self. And that is the great problem of the world, the separated self. I am this separate self, and you're that separate self. And we quarrel with one another, and we kill one another, because we're all different. And until we go beyond the separated self and open up to the deep self, which is always there, behind all the difference, is this unity, this whole. And when we discover that, then the separate self no longer stands in the way. It dissolves into the deeper self, where we're in communion with one another, where we find the whole again. And that is what is happening today, you see, as I say, in the physical sciences. And now in psychology, Jung's concept of the collective unconscious is extremely helpful, you see, because in that view, we have our conscious individual self, very small part of our being, and we realize beneath that conscious individual self, there's all this vast sphere of the unconscious. Unconscious, personal unconscious, feelings, suppressed feelings from childhood and so on. And then beyond that, we all inherit from the past. I remember one Jungian analyst telling me, he thought that as the embryo in the womb recapitulates all the stages of evolution from protoplasm through fish and animal, whatever, up to man. So every human being recapitulates the history of humanity. The whole of humanity is in our past. And the fathers, you know, spoke of Adam. Adam is that humanity, is in everybody. that Adam is in everybody, and that Adam has fallen, of course, and is divided and has to be renewed in the new Adam. So we're discovering now a psychological unity behind all our differences of race and character and language and whatever you like. There is a mysterious unity behind all, every human psyche. There is a hidden unity which unites us all, makes us one. And that unity is not limited by the psyche, it's the deep center of our being. And that's where I find the distinction between the body, the soul, and the spirit is so helpful. It's found in St. Paul, particularly the letter to the Thessalonians, but it's basically his teaching. We have a body, a physical organism, and it's part of the physical organism, the universe, and we're realizing it, and we're responsible for this physical universe of which we are parts. And secondly, we have a psychological organism, and that is part of the psychological organism of the universe. Going right back to the beginning of history, we all inherit and are parts of this whole psychological whole. And then beyond the body and the psyche is the pneuma, the spirit, the Atman. And that is the point of transcendence, where beyond the body, beyond the mind and all its divisions, we discover the original whole, the wholeness which embraces all body and soul and gathers everything into this unity, a transcendent unity, you see. And don't forget, all through the Old Testament, like all ancient religion, they were all searching for that transcendent unity. Yahweh could be very cruel and all the rest and so, but still he had this wonderful, this mercy and compassion, and they realized there's some wonderful mystery in Yahweh, in God, which was drawing us to itself, you see. So there is this unity behind all the diversity is always there, and we're always being drawn towards it, opening. And that is our challenge today, you see, to get beyond the limits of our science, which has limited us to a very, very fragmented view of the universe, and beyond the limits of our psychology, which is still very inadequate. And don't forget, you see, the Western science is still very limited in its scope, and it's not reached the Buddhist science, psychology of Tibet, for instance, is far deeper than the normal Western psychology. So we're discovering a deeper level of psychology, but we're seeing now, we're challenged to go beyond the physical, beyond the psychological, to open ourselves to this hidden mystery, which has no name. That is, you can call it God, or you can give it any other name, Tao, or Brahman, or Nirvana, whatever you like. These are names which point to something which cannot be named. They always say, at the beginning of the Tao Te Ching, it says, the Tao is the Tao itself has no name. When the Tao is given a name, then it becomes a source of everything. But beyond is the nameless Tao, the nameless God, the nameless One. And don't forget, in our Christian tradition, it's equally strong. God has no name. St. Thomas Aquinas was wonderful in that way. You know, he elaborated a theology as complete as you could have. And then he said, everything we can say about God, every image and concept we form and every dogma we create, all these are infinitely remote from the reality of God. He transcends every image and every thought. He is the transcendent to which he's drawing us, you see, beyond ourselves, beyond this ego, beyond this mind with its divising, the dividing power, to the inner center of unity. So, as I see it,